I noticed a change in what was going on was the house carry-on. So we went on a lot called Last Before, which was after house carry. Now, we landed in the Hennings that night, still at a young age. And my team were a reserve assault team. It's back 2-2 up. First assault team went forward to breach into the building, and the kid was under a car and brassed at the first assault team. So the first assault team wiped out, mate. And then obviously standing behind the assault team, that's my first season to get shot, and I was like, holy fuck. This is it. Yeah. And then grenades start getting thrown off the roof at us, and grenades getting thrown back. Suicide bombers were running out of the house, clacking their cells off in front of us. I mean, I can remember thinking, that's like magic. That's the first one I thought. There's a guy in front of me, clacked himself off and he disappeared. I was like, that's like magic. And then you snap back into it like, that's a fucking dude just blowing himself up in front of you.
Welcome to Kid Cage.
Welcome once again to the Kick Cage, and today we have on Dave Radband, who's a former paratrooper and former SFSG. Welcome to the show.
Cheers, thanks for having us, mate.
Let's take you back to the start. Let's get a bit of a backstory on yourself. What influenced you to join the British Armed Forces?
Nothing really. Probably watching war films with my dad at Christmas, you know, watching Bridge Through Fire and things like that. Obviously living next door to Bryce Norton, that kind of a bit of an influence.
And what pointed you in the direction of going in the army in the paras?
Well, from the age of probably about, I think it was 12 years old, I started getting bullied at school. And one of the PGIs, parachute jumping instructors at Bryce Norton, he invited me over to the training school. So I'd done the training school at Bryce when I was about 11, 12. It's like a little bit of an interest period. And I just loved it, mate.
How do you think that bullying at school affected you? Was that a long-term thing going through school, or was it just that brief moment that you were being bullied?
No, that was a long-term thing, mate.
Long-term thing.
Yeah, so I got a thing called borderline personality disorder as well.
Right.
Which is, the Americans call it unstable emotional personality disorder, which is, so as a child, you, from the people around you, you learn to how you think, feel, and there's another one as well, think, feel, and your behaviour.
Yeah.
So because I was bullied at school, my emotional intellect was kind of messed up. And obviously problems at home from my childhood as well with my mum and dad. Their relationship wasn't great. So that kind of had an impact on my childhood as well, if you like. So that's where that kind of stemmed from.
Do you feel that sort of childhood steered you towards the sort of military family aspect?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, well, I went to cadets at a young age. Well, I started cadets. I think you start cadets. What's it? I think it's 11 years old, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's 11. You start cadets. So I started going to cadets from the moment I could. I think I even started like a little bit earlier because my dad knew the guy that was running it, and the whole discipline thing, the whole routine, and you know, I just loved it, mate, and it really took to me. But yeah, I just been like involved in military from a young age, really, playing with action men, all that good stuff.
So obviously you must have joined at quite a young age. Do you feel that you matured as a person in the military?
Massively. I mean, when you go into para depot, I didn't really know what to expect, if I'm honest with you. I think I joined the army more to kind of prove a point to my parents, if anything. I didn't join for me. I mean, I went to the careers office to join the RAF fire service. So my dad kind of pushed me, because I wanted to go into services. He pushed me towards, because he's a fireman for 15 years. So he pushed me towards the RAF. Now, I didn't know they were crap hats at the time. it's just for a bit of a joke out there. But he steered me towards the RAF fire service. But they weren't recruiting at the time. So I went downstairs and joined the bridge. I think I joined the reg to kind of prove a point to my parents that, you know, I can be somebody. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know how hard it would be. Didn't really know much about the paras, if I'm honest with you. I've read books on them, obviously. Watched the bridge too far. But you don't have an insight of how hard it is because you don't know, because you're only a child, mate.
Yeah.
let's be honest, you still are a kid when you're 15, 16, aren't you? You don't really know the hardships of life. So I didn't really know what to expect. And when I got there, it was a massive item for me. And on the terms of maturing, you have to mature, mate. You have to. There's no room for, you know, your childish times and acting like a kid, mate. You have to grow up quite quickly in that environment.
Now, obviously, I really want to get into what you post about quite a lot on social media, which is obviously mental health and yep. PTS. But I want to put that in a bit of context, because you do talk about your own demons and what you went through. So just let's lead up to that. Let's paint a picture in words of how old you were when you were first deployed, and the difference between you going into country and coming back as a person.
So my first deployment was, I passed out of parachute regiment depot on the Friday, went to Dover for a week. That's when we were based in Dover. This is when we were still attached to 16 air assault. So we weren't even SOSG then. Yeah. It was still under the 16 air assault brigade. So I'd done Ireland, and there was even when I was in Parrot Depot, there was all this talk about SOSG going to start, and it was kind of like a new thing. Is it going to start? Is it not? It's going to start. It's not. You know, on the bus, off the bus kind of thing with the army. you stop, start every 5 minutes, and the rumour mill. And you've got to try and find out what's gen and what isn't. And then while I was in Northern Ireland, we got the call two months before the end of our deployment in Northern Ireland, saying that my company were going to Iraq to do the first operational tour with B Squadron 22 SAS. So we started pre-deployment training actually out in Northern Ireland, doing the whole fast roping, you know, method of insurgents and things. That wasn't too bad though. I mean, Ireland's Ireland, isn't it? It's just normal patrolling. There wasn't anything hard going on. I think the hardest thing I had to do was trying to find a magazine that one of the lads had dropped. he got the heli and dropped a magazine. It just, mate, trying to find a magazine, like retrace your steps. I mean, what a nightmare. So then we went to Iraq, my two para were out there at the time. And while I was in Northern Ireland, two para lost two of the guys. So two guys got killed out there. They got hit by a IED. The two blokes in the front were killed, and one of my mates was in the back. And I still spoke to him because obviously we were in depot together. Yeah. And what he was telling me, it was like, he was telling me stuff, like what happened. It's like, you still don't even know what this is because you've not experienced it yet. It's still stuff out of films. Even though you're in the army, it's still stuff out of films, mate, because you've not experienced that yet. So went to Iraq, got into a few scraps with the Iraqi police, believe it or not. My first contact was with the Iraqi police. They rocked up with a 4x4. With a PKM on the back, and just started brassing up our position. So we kind of looked at each other like, yeah, let's do it. So we just like sprayed the car, as you do. I mean, there was like two mini-me's, GPMG, and there's the UKSF, what's it, signals, was it 18-6 squad? Is it 18-6?
Oh, for recce.
Yeah, so there's one of those guys, and then there's a 2-2 guy there with us. We just brass car up, but still, you haven't experienced anything because it's from a distance.
Yeah.
So because things are from a distance, you still haven't experienced it. You still haven't experienced anything. So you've not really changed as a person because, like I say, there's no hardship there. There's no hardship experience, mate. I mean, a firefight's a firefight, but it's not anything hard, mate. It's
at a distance, isn't it? You can almost remove yourself from the situation.
Yeah, yeah. Because the rounds, I mean, for about 5 seconds, I'll probably hit you on a palm tree. But because no rounds are actually landing in your area, their rounds that are just going down the street. There's nothing landing around you, or like, you know, rounds going beside you, or whatever, mate. So you've not actually experienced anything again. It's just rounds being fired in your general direction.
Yeah.
So then, cover, you know, operations kept going like that. But then when I noticed a change in what was going on was the Al's Kawi op. So we went on an op called Op Larchwood 4, which was after Al's Kawi. Now, we landed in the helis that night, still at a young age. And my team were a reserve assault team to back 2-2 up. first assault team went forward to breach into the building, and the kid was under a car and brassed at the first assault team. So the first assault team wiped out, mate. And then obviously standing behind the assault team, that's when I first see somebody get shot, and I was like, holy fuck, this is it.
Yeah.
And then grenades start getting thrown off the roof at us, and grenades getting thrown back. Suicide bombers were running out of the house, cracking their cells off in front of us. I mean, I can remember thinking, that's like magic. That's the first thing I thought. There's a guy in front of me, cracked himself off, and he disappeared. I was like, that's like magic. And then you snap back into it, like, that's a fucking dude just blowing himself up in front of you. Because if you start hearing the thud, and like bits of him hit the ground around you, and that's when it was, yeah, this is war. And that's when I started noticing. That's when I really noticed a change. And from that point on, going out on other missions, it was always, you always had that feeling in your body. I never had that feeling before because, again, I never experienced anything. Never experienced anything that was hard or traumatic or mentally traumatic. But that was when I'm, you know, every time I went on the ground, I started feeling that little, you know, the heart rate go up a little bit more.
So obviously, you know, you've still had a job to do. You've just witnessed all this go off right in front of you. Two things I want to sort of take away from this part of the conversation. One, obviously working so closely with Special Forces as Special Forces support group, did you realize how ally your position was in the armed forces without reaching Special Forces? And secondly, at what point after did you allow yourself to truly decompress, analyze, decompartmentalize everything that just happened in front of you on that day?
That operation was only supposed to be a short tour. We're certainly supposed to do 4 months, and then the Marines are supposed to come out and take over us.
Yeah.
But the Marines failed the PDT to come and take over us, so we ended up staying an extra 2 months. And then we got back to UK. But at this point there was no decompression training in Cyprus. There's none of that. It was just like straight back to UK, straight back into normal wear life. But it's like a fish out of water experience because you've just been fighting, you've just been getting shot at, and the guys were with the Kazakh civilians. I mean, that night alone, there's a woman that walked out the house holding a baby, and she had no jaw, mate. Her jaw was gone. We think she got hit by the guys are shotgunning in the door.
Yeah.
She got hit by a slug, mate, and it just took her jaw off. So we had to square that away. But in terms of recognising how ally we didn't really think we were ally then, because we didn't have all the ally kit then. We had the normal kit. The only thing that was ally was you wearing BDUs that you cut around like it. You know, in the daytime, you go into a swimming pool in Camp Liberty with the Americans and like eating Burger King and KFC and donuts, mate. And then at night, you're going out on ops. But I think when we knew we were actually a well-established ally unit was when we was in Afghanistan, mate, on Op Rigo. That was probably the best op in Afghanistan. That's what this painting is here.
Yeah.
And that's the patch that I wore on my Afghan tours. But that was, that's when we, even 2-2 were trying to, like 2-2 SES were trying to take that operation off us. They were trying to say, like, we want Rigo. And DSF was saying, no, that's their bread and butter. They're like, leave it to the reg. They're war fighters. You stick to kicking doors in. They're say doing like company platoon section attacks.
So by the time you got to Afghanistan and you were doing all this door kicking, was it? Could you tell that it was taking a toll on you mentally?
Yeah. So after my 2005 Iraq tour, I went to Kosovo. I've done an operation out in Kosovo with SRR. I can't really talk much about that one.
Yeah.
I've been warned off not to say too much about that in podcasts and things.
That's fine.
Especially writing my book that's coming out soon. I've been warned off not to even mention that in it. So I've done that. And then I went on Iraq. So in Iraq 2008 again, which was as we were pulling out of Iraq, we'd done the IDF team and we were door kicking then as well. So we were actually assault team one on that, up with a D Squadron SAS guy that was our breacher. Yeah. But I started after that. So it's after that tour that I started noticing it was taking a toll on me because we were actually killing people from, you know, close distance, mate.
Yeah.
That was when you were like, that's when you can see the emotion in people's faces. That's when you can see the emotion in the kids' faces. That's when you can see the emotion in the family. You know, when you've just shot a guy or whatever and you're ripping the family apart, or so, you know, one of your mates has shot somebody, you're ripping the family apart, or, you know, then you leave the house and then you're hearing all the screams while you're walking away from the house, and that's when you start. That's when you notice.
At that moment, were you able to realize that you were, you know, you in essence doing a job? Or were you, you know, were you caught up in a moment? You witnessed that, as you say, you hear the screams, he's leaving. Was it, you know, chilling to the bone? Or could you, you know, separate yourself?
Yeah, you felt that, like, you didn't feel good about it. You didn't feel, because they're kids. They do, especially when it's kids, mate. The women in my eyes are just as bad in Iraq and Afghanistan. They're just as bad as the old man. They know what they're getting into.
Yeah.
They understand the risks of what's going on. And in some cases, they're just as bad in terms of hiding weapons or phones on their person. But when it's children, the children don't know, mate. And it's a lot harder when there's a child in front of you crying because you've just done something, or your mate's done something, or the child stood over his dad's dead body. It's a lot more, it's not more, like you say, chilling to the bone. It hits your, it pulls on your heartstrings a lot more. Yeah. And at the end of the day, we're only human, mate. We might be, you know, people might think we're superheroes or whatever, because we can door kick or assault buildings and do things, but we're still human, mate. And I think that's one thing that we kind of, I don't know, tried to push to the back of our minds and try and just push through it, try and detach ourselves from reality.
And that's not always a good thing, is it? When you start doing that.
No, I for one, when I was in Afghanistan, I was detaching myself from what was the truth and what, you know, just detaching myself from my surroundings, if you like. I was trying to just put everything to the back of my mind and not even process it, mate. Just push it. Just forget about it. Just get on with it.
Were you believing in yourself that you were coping with everything that was happening to you?
Yeah. But I was only lying to myself.
Yeah.
But it's like a drug addict, isn't it? You know, the more you do it, the more you lie to yourself.
Yeah.
And essentially, adrenaline's a drug, isn't it? And when it's very confusing, mate, because when even though you're feeling this emotion that's hurting you mentally and, you know, sometimes physically, because you're doing a lot of extreme fizz, if you like, it's quite, you know, it's hard on your body. You still lie to yourself, mate. Like a drug, the drug addict lies to himself. The more you do it, the more you lie to yourself. It's okay. I can keep doing this.
Absolutely.
And yeah, and like I say, mate, it's confusing because you chase it more. You do chase it, and although it's hurting you, you chase it.
Yeah, you're chasing the adrenaline buzz of the job you're doing. You're wanting the more dangerous ops. You're wanting to be in the thick of it, even though you realise it is causing yourself mental damage.
Yeah.
Was there any point that the people around you, friends, family, or even service colleagues, were starting to notice a change in you?
Yeah, that was... So I started coming home. Now, people where I live know me as the lad who got bullied at school. Then I started coming home and I kind of turned into the bully, mate, where I was going out fighting all the time because I was looking for conflict. Mm. And I was looking for that adrenaline buzz. And if somebody stood up to me, I was good to go, mate. And I was getting in a lot of trouble. I was getting arrested at weekends. I was go on leave. I'd have to go and say that I've got in trouble again. And that was kind of my routine, if you like. I was known as the G1 drama, mate. there's a poem that's actually written about me, and it says, what does it say? wish I had it in here because it says about me being a G1 driver and that, mate. And but what goes with that is Power Reg have a reputation of fighting all the time.
Yeah.
And being aggressive. So nobody really looks at it in that way. I wasn't coming back off the piss crying. I wasn't getting into anything like that. I was just angry. But what I've learned since I've been out, there's two types of aggression for me. There's angry and emotional, and there's angry and aggressive.
Yeah.
And I think they're the two things that need to be looked at. Because, yeah, I think looking back, I was hurting, and that was my release.
Is that the point where you probably think if you'd had the emotional intelligence to realise that you were looking for a way to release this emotional energy, that no, perhaps you would have put it in a different direction?
I didn't really know what PTS was back then. I mean, I'm talking 2009 here.
Yeah. Very early on, isn't it? Even talking about it.
Although we all got told about shell shock in, you know, in school from the World Wars, although we all, you know, which essentially evolved into PTS, didn't it? Same thing. No one was really taught about it. So, I mean, looking back now, I can see other guys that were in my team that were struggling. Looking back now, for what I know now, but at the time, I didn't know that. If I had known that, I could have, you know, we could have, you know, sat around, had better chats, mates, supported each other a bit more. Still done the job, but supported each other more. Yeah. But we didn't know what was going on. We didn't know why we were feeling the way we did. There's no direction of our emotion, mate, or our feelings. It was just get on and do the job.
That's, you know, one of the big reasons why I do this podcast is to really try and raise the awareness of, you know, PTS, TBIs and mental health, especially when it comes to veterans and service personnel, because there is always going to be that stigma that if, you know, as a door kicker, you suddenly turn around and start saying, well, I'm having these, you know, mental health issues. You know, I'm not feeling on top of my game today because of X, Y, Z. There is a stigma and a fear that they're going to lose their seat on the team. Now, one of the ways to get rid of the stigma, I do personally believe, and, you know, you've done it yourself. You just said PTS instead of saying PTSD. If we, you know, acknowledge that it's not a disorder and that it's an injury, then perhaps we can start talking about it more openly and honestly between players.
Yeah. When you're a door kicker as well, what people don't understand is, or when you're, you know, you're assaulting buildings, with it, because I noticed this when you said about the TBIs, and that's what kind of made me think about this, what people don't realise is, when you get to a building, you've got an outside compound in buildings.
Yeah.
So you put the charge on the outside building. Now, you step away from that door charge, that gate charge, and you crack that off. Now, when you get to the door, if that door's not breached, you put another charge on, but you're stood here, the door's there, and you're blowing the door that close, mate. Now, that's an, you're doing that. Now, if you do that 3 times a night, that's an explosion going off right next to you.
Oh, yeah.
And sometimes you can do that 3 times in a night. You know, crack a door off right next to you. Or, you know, there's one time where one of the 2-2 guys put a charge on the door, and I've got my lightning bolt on. I see him putting the charge on the door, and he didn't tell me to clack it off. He's like, bang. I was like, fuck yeah. And yeah, the lads had to throw me out the way to get in the house.
Obviously, you know, being that close to those sort of explosions and having the concussion and the impact, do you think you personally felt it?
Yeah, massively. Had a massive impact on me. I even nowadays, people say to me about my memory loss, I can't remember what I'd done yesterday half the time. People have to constantly remind me of dates, and that's obviously a key factor of a TBI, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, there's also, I've been blown up 4 times in vehicles and once on foot. So there's obviously those explosions as well, which are obviously bigger than just a standard door charge.
Yeah.
You also got the concussion of constant flashbangs in training.
Yep.
I mean, flashbangs, six bangers, even training standard, they still give you that little, you know, that little rib, that rib, you know, rubble. Grenades.
Yep.
When you grenades or not. Mate, there's loads of things that are, you know, explosions you're around all the time. I mean, even something as little as dropping a 500-pounder, I mean, you know, not far away. I mean, not even danger close, mate. You still feel it in your body.
How well do you think TBIs are known in the British Army? Because obviously it's a big thing in the US military with TBIs and having the show SEAL Team portray TBIs in the show, which has given good awareness in the US. Do you think
it's funny you say that. So you mentioned SEAL Team. So yeah. My mum started watching it. Yeah. I was flicking through it one day and I come across it. I didn't even know what SEAL Team was at the time. Also, I know what the SEAL Teams are, but I didn't know this program. And I thought, oh, I need another cheesy program. And I actually watched it. I thought, fucking hell, that actually drilled the skills. They're actually better than some of the blokes I know. So I took it to it and I started watching it a bit more. So I got my mum into it. My mum said, you're just like, your attitude's just the same as Jason Hayes. And that's kind of when you know that he's portrayed a soldier quite well, when he's got the same mannerisms as somebody struggling or going through that.
They've got a very, very good crew around them. A lot of ex-ed operators are, you know, on the crew doing advice and that. And I think the program itself does a marvelous thing of raising awareness of mental health issues and TBIs.
With respect to, what was it you said about?
Do you think it's well known in the UK, TBIs?
Well, yeah. So I don't think it is, mate. I think they're miles ahead of us in terms of understanding TBI and PTS, also the recovery stages. Yeah. I mean, they're already trialing psychedelic drugs, and I actually went to Costa Rica 4 years ago. I think it's 4 years ago where I went to Costa Rica into the jungle and done ayahuasca.
Yeah.
And that's when everyone see a change in me again. So they've seen me as a kid. So my family, you know, people around me, the closest people around me, have obviously seen me as a kid. Then they've seen me go into the army, pass out of training, and see me turn into like that pub paratrooper that just wants to fight everybody every 5 minutes and just like, you know, that gobshite attitude.
Yeah.
Then go into like conflict and come out a broken man.
Yeah.
And then come out the other side, you know, semi-healed, if you like.
Yeah.
So in terms of recovery, mate, they're way ahead of us.
Do you think the UK are going to catch up? Do you think the MOD is going to catch up, or is it going to be things like this veteran startups that are going to actually help TBIs before the MOD does?
I think it's us as a community that will sort it out, if I'm honest with you. I mean, there's not even... I've got more mates that are non-parachute regiment, not non-ferocious types. I've got more mates probably now that are not paras, mate. Because it's not about regimental stuff nowadays, it's about the whole community as a
veteran as a whole.
Yeah, it's about helping each other out,
yeah.
I mean, I was attached to the Welsh Guards for 6 months in 2009. I spent most of my time on Tiger teams with the Welsh Guards.
Yeah.
So I formed like quite a good relationship with some of those guys. Being away from my personal unit.
Yeah.
And that's kind of been my attitude towards the whole crap out thing and, you know, all that silly nonsense change then, because you actually realise that they're going through a lot more than us. I mean, SOSG, we got ensuite showers, beds, duvets, pillows,
cushy life.
Lockers that we put our kit in.
Yeah.
We got a scoff house that we have like surf and turf night, steak night. I mean, we go out and get in some tasty scraps. But we're back home having like, you know, egg banjos. As soon as you hit that plane, mate, on the heli, you're like, yeah, get the egg banjos on. You land and you're having a can of Coke with egg banjos, mate. And then you go to bed. And that's kind of when it all changed me.
Absolutely. So let's talk about you leaving the military and, you know, coming into the civvy populace. Was it your decision to come out of the military? Or was it just your time of contract? Or was it...
No, I got kicked out for steroids.
Right.
I started taking steroids 2008 when I was in Iraq. Yeah, I didn't really have an understanding of what it was, just wanted to get bigger, better condition. So I started taking it. It wasn't anything to do with PCS or anything. It wasn't anything. I just wanted to just look good, if you like. You know, everyone has this image of what a paratrooper should look like.
Yeah,
an SFSG soldier should look like, or a two-tube soldier should look like. And it's always that hairy-ass fucking big bloke, isn't it?
You wanted to live up to that, obviously. And
yeah, so, I mean, everybody was on it, mate. We had SEAL Team 4 attached to us in 2008. So we were working with the SEAL Team 4 guys.
Yeah.
And they were smashing CrossFit even back in 2004, mate. And I didn't, when I returned to the UK, I didn't hear about CrossFit until like 2011. And they were doing it in 2008, mate.
Yeah.
So, but they were smashing the gear. And they were all big lads.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of become the norm, and then all of a sudden, around about 2013, I'd say, everyone started getting a massive hard on about it. I mean, 2009, I went out on Tiger Teams, and I was anorexic, mate. My mum didn't even recognize me when I went on Skype to her. I was so skinny in the face. I don't know if you've seen the photograph of my on my Instagram, but I'm really skinny in the face with long hair and like a semi beard because I couldn't grow one back then. Yeah, it's pathetic, mate. about 2 weeks later, mate, I blew up because I started taking steroids. I started taking Deca and it also blows you up.
Yeah.
And my OC at the time, who actually was my CEO at the time and kicked me out, he actually said to me in crossing paths on our camp, Cook Rubber, are you on steroids? I went, yes, sir. And the lads are like, why have you just admitted to that? I was like, well, look at the fucking size of me. I'm not going to lie, am I? and he knew then, back then I was. Yeah. But it was just, at the time I was kicked out, there was three guys from the SAS, a few guys from the SBS, five guys from SOSG. And it was just to make an example of us, I think. There's a lot of conspiracy theories where people say someone's grassed you up because you were struggling, you become a drama, there was things going on, like they could see you going downhill. I mean, there's all that, but I think it was just more of a setting, you know, we're gonna get this out. If somebody comes into a position in the army like an officer, they want to put their stamp on something, don't they?
Yeah.
And if he doesn't like steroids, he'll put a stamp on it and kick a few blads out to prove a point, isn't he?
And Do you think the alpha male culture that you were in, being surrounded by, you know, these, as you say, these big hairy ass special forces guys, do you think that was breeding the culture and the image that ultimately made you have the decision to do steroids while in the service?
No, I don't think it was so much that. I know for a fact, I mean, when I was when I went to Afghan, some of the tabs we're doing, so we'd be in contact with the Taliban for hours.
Yeah.
And then we'd have to do a 60K extraction tab with all our kit. I mean, sometimes you have to carry the Afghans because the Afghans are hanging out, mate. And you have to literally carry them or you take their kit off them and you got, so your day sack on, a day sack over the top.
Yeah.
You got a weapon strapped to you and then you got your weapon. And then you got an Afghan running behind you with no kit. the job I was doing at the time, I could not have done it without steroids, mate.
Yeah.
And I mean, we're all on steroids out there. We're all banging it in us. And that's the thing, mate. Like, I don't think there's probably like two or three guys, maybe like a few more that weren't doing it. But most of us, if not pretty much all of us, were banging it in us. Yeah. And it's just, I abused it and got too big and got caught out, mate.
Was it obviously that sudden growth that was, you know, brought you to the attention of the CO and obviously ultimately cost you your military career? How did that make you feel as you were being forced out of the parachute regiment?
Well, at the time it happened, I'd just come off counterterrorism and I was doing PDT to go back out for my sixth Afghan tour.
Yeah.
I was just getting ready to go to Oman to do the PDT for that tour. And by the time they kicked me out, my team were deploying. So during that period, they were out there doing PDT. I was stuck back in the UK, just getting paid to do nothing. Yeah. And then they deployed when I was civvy. And obviously living right next to Bryce Norton. The thing that broke me was I went to Bryce Norton to see all the lads off and stood in the terminal. So I still had my ID card at the time. So I just got on camp with my mum because my mum knew through the geezer as well.
Yeah.
And yeah, saying goodbye to him literally broke my fucking heart, mate.
What was the coming months like for you as a civilian?
The hardest thing is trying to find your feet, mate. Trying to find what you're good at. I mean, for the last, 12 years, I'd known nothing more than kicking doors and having contacts and just scrapping, mate. You're trying to find what can I do now. So I went on a task. A mate of mine, as I got in, a couple of years down the line, he got out to do CP and then he got back in as I got kicked out. So he gave me a few contacts and he got me a job looking after George Clooney for a little while.
Wow.
And then I went doing CP for a little while, which is all right.
Yeah,
it's all right, but it's not the military, is it?
No.
It's not the military. It's a lot of just sitting around watching TV series and trying to look pretty and in bad conditions, mate. So then I went on a ship to try and see a bit more, you know, nicer places.
Yeah.
Sri Lanka and Djibouti, Suez Canal. And that was quite good, actually. That wasn't too bad. The worst bit was just sitting on vessels.
Was that counter-piracy?
Yes, mate. Yeah.
Yeah.
That wasn't too bad. And then, I broke in rugby after that. Quite badly. I snapped it in four places. So I stopped doing... after I broke my leg, I went out during monsoon season. And obviously the ship's doing this. You're trying to get stabilised and... my leg's not longer just been pinned together, mate. So I stopped doing that and I ended up doing surveillance for the Kazakhstan government.
Yeah.
For 2 years I was doing surveillance for the Kazakhstan government on there's like a lot of targets and mainly in Europe, like Lithuania, Switzerland, loads of countries, and we ended up doing surveillance on.
What was your mental state during this period? Were you hiding everything? Were you denying that there was stuff going on? Were you perhaps self-medicating with alcohol or whatever to try and ease what you were going through? And at what point did you finally admit to yourself that there was something, you know, quite wrong?
So if we were to rewind a little bit, on my 2011 Afghan tour, I was blown up for my last time in a vehicle. We were in LUP, just getting ready to go in. So we got there at night time during the dark hours. I was in an Australian Bushmaster. I was the RWS gunner on it, on the lead vehicle. And morning comes, go and do the attack. And as we set off, we literally got about 200 metres, mate. We hit an ID. And that's close, mate, to our LUP, that.
Yeah.
And that's the last time I got blown up that. We got recovered back to camp to Fort Price. Do you remember Fort Price?
No, I don't know.
So the Estonians, so that's where the Estonians are. The Estonians recovered us back. And I hadn't really processed it. Because we got back to the camp and we were kind of like different. We look different, so you're kind of walking around with your chest out like that cocky bloke again. But it's only when I got back to my own camp that my body kind of relaxed and was like, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah.
And I can remember in the vehicle park having a meltdown. Instead of, I'm next to the vehicle, my vehicle has just been whacked. Walking back to my room with all my kit, and I had what I now know as a panic attack, mate. But at the time, I didn't know what a panic attack was, mate. I've never been taught what a panic attack is. I just felt something go wrong in my body and I knew it wasn't fucking good, mate. And that's when I knew something was wrong. Because every time I went on the ground from that moment, I changed. I was scared, mate. Every time I went out on a mission then, I was worried if something was going to go on. And it kind of, it changed my soldiering skills, mate, in a certain sense.
What made you less of a risk taker?
Yeah, definitely, mate. Made me, just made me more aware of what was going on around me. More, like, assess the situation more, not going too hasty.
Yeah.
And that's almost, you can take that almost for, fear.
Yeah.
It is fear, mate.
Was it fear of the situation or fear of dying that was holding you back?
You know what? I couldn't tell you, mate, if I'm honest with you. But all I know is I felt fear for probably the first time in my life at the time.
And the fear was that strong it caused you to have a panic attack?
Yeah. But again, mate, you don't get taught this stuff.
No, you don't.
You don't get told what a panic attack is. You don't get told what PTS is. You don't get these lessons. You don't get told about emotion. It's they're taboo subjects, mate, in our unit. You don't talk about stuff to people. And I had to keep that quiet, mate, so I knew if I told somebody what had happened to me in that vehicle park, that's me sent back to the UK, mate. I'm gone.
Yeah. And do you think that culture needs to change, or do you think there is always going to be an element of that culture?
Yeah, I think that needs to be made aware of what the process is, because everybody thinks that when you talk about that or you say something that's happened, that's the end of your career.
Yeah.
Everyone thinks it.
Yeah.
But let's be honest, mate. Everyone thinks the end of your career, you're taken off of ops, you're not allowed to handle the weapon, and they think that's it. But there needs to be, people need to be taught what the process is and what happens if you feel something's going wrong with you. It's not just you're cut off from the military. You're not going to get MD'd.
Yeah.
You're going to get the help you need, and then you'll be back in.
Yeah. So let's move on to obviously your social media. You've got quite a strong brand going. What was your inspiration behind doing that? Was it something that just grew because you've become quite philosophical in what you've been posting on social media?
Well, I actually had one before. So I had a profile before the one I've got now that got hacked and deleted.
Right.
And that one had, I think, 28,000 followers, I think. And that one got so many followers because when I left the military, stuff got so hard that I actually tried to kill myself twice. So I stabbed myself in the stomach with a kitchen knife and almost bled to death. Okay. And then I hung myself in my parents' house. My mum and dad found me and done CPR on me and brought me back to life. So I started, at that point in my life, I actually thought I'm going to die at some point soon. So I started blogging about it to help people. So I just started blogging about mental health to help people, and it turned into something where it was actually helping me. Because it was actually, I couldn't sit down and talk to somebody.
Yeah.
Because I felt awkward talking face to face to someone. I started getting all jittery and couldn't have eye contact. And I just felt weird talking to somebody about that, because again, it's a taboo subject, and I've never felt open talking about some stuff like that.
Yeah.
So my kind of way of expressing my feelings was by posting. And it was a way of getting stuff off my chest, or that weight off your shoulders, if you like. Or as I say, emptying your emotional bucket.
Yeah.
I mean, we've all got buckets inside us, haven't we? We need to empty it sometimes. If you let it overflow, it's an explosion, mate. And that's when it gets too much. But if you punch holes in that bucket by talking or crying or cuddling or whatever, mate, you're releasing that overflow.
Absolutely. Now, did you ever think that you'd get such a following when it comes to talking about mental health as a veteran?
No. But then again, it went the other way as well, mate, because what I didn't realise was when you get so many followers, people cling to you for help.
Yeah.
And people message you, and then you feel you've got a duty to help these people. But the world's too big and you can't help everybody, mate.
No, you can only sort of signpost them in the right direction.
Yeah, and it cost too much for me at one point, and I had to kind of go, do you know what, I need to take a step back from this.
Yeah.
Because it's getting, just take the app, don't delete the profile, just take the app off your phone a little bit and just have like a bit of a breathing space.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to, when people bombard you with messages, because Instagram only takes so many words,
Yeah.
So sometimes you get messages that are, mate, turbo long. And then it's another message. Then it's another message. And it's, I mean, there's one woman that was messaging me constantly about her husband beating her up. And I was saying, go to the police. And she's like, I can't go to the police. And I was trying to help her out, but nothing I said was working.
Yeah.
I kind of had to take a step back, and I hate to say it, but I had to block her because it started to affect me.
Yeah. No, I can appreciate that.
And as hard as it is, mate, as hard as it was, I had to, because everything, I did everything I could to try and help her, but nothing, she didn't take any of it in. It was just always, you know, there's always an excuse or, I mean, it's probably not her fault, is it? But, yeah, it just started to affect me. So I had to remove myself from that situation, mate.
Yeah.
And that's what people don't understand is when you're blogging about mental health and things, people do confine in you for help, but you can't help everybody, and you need to understand that.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the things that I've learned doing this is, you know, I don't have all the answers. I'm a conduit for people to talk and express, you know, their opinions, and hopefully their opinions might resonate with someone to the point where they'll reach out for help.
Yeah.
I don't have all the answers, but I can point them in the direction of, you know, places that they can find help,
yeah,
be it the Samaritans, be it veterans associations, be it, you know, just veterans group that we can talk to. So that's what I try and do. I try and, you know, signpost them in their direction. So
that's kind of what I do nowadays. I kind of point people in the direction of the charity that helped me out, which was Rock to Recovery. They're the ones that kind of squared me away. I went to the NHS to start with, and I know the NHS is, you know, undermanned, underfunded, whatever you want to call it. But in terms of mental health, they're way behind as well. In terms of like mental health with veterans, maybe with like civilians, I don't know. But in terms of like military, yes. Because when I went to the NHS and I started to go through the whole process, I was trying to find out what was actually wrong with me. And they said, you don't need to know what's wrong with you. And I was like, I do. Because I've been trained to fight every situation. You put me in front of a door, in front of the Taliban, whatever, I can fight that. If you tell me what I'm fighting, I can start looking into it. I can start trying to, you know, understand what's going on.
Yeah.
And I can fight this. But I need to know what's going on. They were like, you don't need to know what's going on. Anyway, I kept fighting it. And they diagnosed me with PTS and borderline personality disorder.
Yeah.
So I was like, good, there's a starting point.
Yep.
But then going through the process, there was no relationship built. It was just ticking boxes. They treat the title, not the person. Now, if you put 100 people in a room that's got PTS or borderline personality disorder, they're all going to have their own unique...
Oh, absolutely. Their
own, like, triggers.
Yep.
But they don't treat the person, they treat the title, mate.
Yeah.
And what I noticed was when I went to Rock to Recovery, on my first session, I said, oh, I've been diagnosed with PTS and borderline personality disorder. And they went, forget about that. We don't want to know about it. We don't want to know about that. We're going to treat you as a person.
Yeah.
And that's when they started. And even going back to the NHS, mate, one day the guy said to me, so what have you been doing, Dave? And I went, oh, I've been spending some time with my kids. And he went, what's your kids' names? I went, there's no rapport here. Well, I've been seeing you for the last 3 months. You're not even taking any notice of my kids, what their names are. This is just a tick in the box exercise. And also, what a frustrating thing for me was when I'm talking to a doctor, I'm talking about Afghan. You say to them about an A10 strafing run, they're like that. you say to them about a contact, they're like, you know, so you have them constantly going into detail of what's happening.
And sometimes that doesn't help you, does it, when you're going into the detail of everything?
But the fact that helped me as well is when I went to Rock to Recovery, you're talking to people that know about the military. You're talking to sometimes soldiers, mate, that are now life coaches.
Yeah.
And they understand it. So when you're spieling things off.
Yeah, you've got the common language, haven't you?
And there's a rapport there as well, because they actually take interest in your life outside of your mental health as well, your life back home.
Yeah.
And that's where I noticed a massive difference in even that first session at Rock to Recovery. I felt a massive weight off my shoulders, mate. I felt like, do you know what? This is going to help me.
Yeah. Did that help you with your social media posts? Was it reflection of that help that you got that made you want to do more?
So a lot of times when I was having therapy, I'd have like what you call a light bulb moment, where you understand something.
Yeah.
So when we're talking in a session, I'm like, oh, that's why I feel that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's why I've done that. Oh, that's why this is. So you start understanding yourself more, and you're more in tune with your body and mind, mate. So you understand things, you understand your triggers, you understand what goes off. I mean, loud, sharp bangs set me off.
Yeah.
Although I shout a lot, like road rage.
So obviously, at the beginning of the interview, you spoke about, you know, you've written a book. Now, where did the inspiration for this book come from, and what can be found inside it?
I toyed with the idea because obviously in units like ours and like SOSG, well, there's not been one in SOSG yet, apart from, I think it's Nick Dunn who done one about the Chiang Kai-6 who was in prison. But apart from that, no one's done one on SOSG. But I think my story is kind of unique, as in the fact that I got PTS and borderline personality disorder. I live with borderline personality disorder as a soldier, because it's a hidden mental health condition that I had from a kid.
Yeah.
And then obviously growing into have PTSD, PTS from Afghan, etc.
Yeah.
So living with two mental health conditions kind of made me think, how many other people, you know, live with these? And how many other people think I'm the only one? So I kind of thought, do you know what? The fact that people look at soldiers like us as superheroes as well, if you can kind of go out there and open yourself up, as open up to emotion, open up to talking, men will think, if he can do it, I can do it.
Yeah.
And my books, it's not going to be about gobbing off about what I've done in the military. I mean, there's got to be some element of the military in there, because some of the reason I have mental health is because some of the things I've done within that environment.
It's got to be contextual.
Yeah, but I want it to be more on the mental health side of it, and how like psychedelic drugs help me.
Yeah.
How the process of getting help, the process of being in a hole and I didn't think I could ever get out of it, and ended up being out of it to where I am now. I mean, I own two companies now. I work on the railway where I employ veterans. So I put veterans into work. And, you know, looking back, I look back now and think, I feel sorry for that guy, the guy I used to be, because I was in such a fucking bad place, like a real bad place. But I'm also proud, and really proud of myself to be where I am now. And I think when people say this is another thing that people don't like. They look at it as being big-headed when you say I'm proud and I'm awesome, but these things are affirmations, mate.
Yeah.
Your affirmations can help you in life. But people put it down as, oh, you're being big-headed, or you're talking, you know, you're bigging yourself up. You're not bigging yourself up. You're talking good about yourself, which actually puts you in a better headspace.
Yeah.
And that's something else we need to get out of as men.
Absolutely. Did you find writing this book almost as a form of therapy for yourself, sort of taking it out of your mind and put it on paper? Were you able to put some situations from your past to bed?
Well, I haven't actually written it. I've got a ghostwriter doing it for me.
Right.
So I just talk on the phone. But funny enough, mate, it brought back a lot of stuff. So I went through a bit of a bad time when I was doing it. I'll be on the phone and I'll be talking about a certain situation. I'll be like, I've got to phone you back. Put the phone down. And I was phoning up my counsellor. I'm like, mate, I've got to talk to you.
And when do we expect to see that hitting the shelf then?
When the army pull their finger out and give me the all clear, mate.
Are you still covered in red tape, is it?
Yeah. Which, mate, could be any time.
Yeah.
Look, you know what it's like, mate.
Yeah.
Hurry up and wait.
Yes. They'll be there with the black marker scrubbing out several words and several lines as they're going along and say, you can't say that, you can't say that, you can't say that.
I'm aiming for summertime. For summertime, mate. But I'm not really bothered when it comes out, as long as it does, mate.
Yeah.
I'm not in it for money. I'm not in it for publicity. I'm in it just get it out there.
Yeah. So what does the future look like for you then? What is the plans regarding your work towards championing mental health for veterans?
Just keep doing what I'm doing, really. I mean, just want to get more people talking about it, mate. More, especially more veterans. Yeah. I mean, every time you hear about a veteran committing suicide, mate, it just makes you want to do it more. I mean, there's been a few times where I wanted to give up my Instagram account, but then when you hear about people committing suicide, it's just, they're the ones that make you keep it. Yeah. Sometimes, like I say, it does get stressful. But I just want to get more veterans just trying to sort themselves out, mate. Just trying to get the help they need.
Absolutely.
Trying to get rid of that stigma and that taboo subject, mate. Because let's be honest, it's still around.
Yeah, definitely, it's still around, but I think it's a little bit better than what it used to be.
Yeah.
But hopefully, you know, having conversations like this between each other, hopefully we can move things forward to a better place. Yeah. Catch up with how well the US are doing.
But it's also getting us to talk about their experiences, because there's also this stigma that talking about your experiences from Afghanistan, as from Afghanistan or Iraq,
yeah,
it's big time, it.
Yeah.
You're not big time, it. You're talking about your experiences to get a weight off your shoulder, or to like make yourself feel a bit better, mate. You're getting weight off your chest.
Yeah.
And you know, when you hear lads going, "Oh, you're big time in it." No. You're trying to get everyone to speak about their experiences, mate. Everyone should be able to speak about their experiences.
Well, good or bad, because let's face it, like you were saying about having the stress bucket and filling it up with things, you know, it can be the same thing. You've lived these experiences, you're almost putting them in a pop bottle, and the less you talk about them, the more you're shaking that
exactly,
bottle.
Exactly, mate.
And when you do finally take that lid off,
yeah,
it goes everywhere. It's a big mess.
You put holes in it, mate.
Exactly. So let's talk about that for a minute then. What things do you do to put holes in that stress bucket? Obviously, you know, you're looking like a big lager. I would imagine that you're still going to the gym. What
you started back in the gym 2 weeks ago.
So what is it that you do to, you know, drain the stress bucket a bit?
I put everything into my work nowadays, mate.
Yeah.
Keep my mind focused. But if I stop, if my mind takes a back seat and just chills out,
yeah,
that's when intrusive thoughts starts coming in, mate, and I start analysing stuff and overthinking, if you like.
Yeah.
So I need to keep myself busy. Now, I mean, my kids keep me busy.
Yeah. I know that feeling.
Yeah, keep me real busy. Them, mate. I mean, my whole weekends, my little girl plays football on a Sunday, my little boy plays football on a Saturday, so that's, and I hate football. I'm getting into it a little bit now, like. Even my brother-in-law said the other day, it's weird talking about football to you. So I just try and put everything into, I just try and keep my mind busy, mate. I mean, yeah. I want to start getting back up the hills again. So I used to get up Penny Fan a lot. I used to get up Ben Nevis.
Yeah.
I actually almost got caught out at Ben Nevis 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I went up with a load of Power Edge guys and a Royal Marine, two Royal Marines, sorry. And we almost got caught out with our pants down. We had to call in Mountain Rescue.
Yeah.
Yeah, we made a pact that we'd rather dive than call in.
There's that alpha male mentality, rather dive than admit defeat.
We're digging in, mate. I just try and keep myself busy, go to the gym. But a lot of what helps me nowadays is being aware of my triggers, mate.
Yeah,
I'm aware of my triggers, mate. I'm aware of what sets me off.
Yeah,
and that helps me a lot.
And for the benefit of other people, I think it's once you first admit that you have this issue, then and only then you can actually realise what your triggers are and, you know, protect yourself from those triggers.
Well, this is it, mate. Once you admit that you need help, that's the first step. But the second step is surrendering yourself to that help, mate. Because if you go, you can go through the process of getting help, but unless you surrender yourself to getting help, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
You're just literally going there for a process. But if you surrender yourself and go into your therapy, if you like, with open arms, that's when you'll start noticing the change in your behavior and you're becoming more of a more positive person. And you'll be aware of your surroundings, your triggers.
What do you think the benefit is of veteran startups? I know America is very big with veteran startups. Black Rifle Coffee, Bone Frog Coffee. There's a lot of, you know, companies that are based from the veteran community. Obviously, you've got ENA, Hats, Ert, Rogue American. Now in the UK, we don't have a lot of veteran-owned startups. Obviously, I can see you're sporting one yourself, Through Dark. There's Lost Tribe, but then I start to run out of British veteran startups. Do you think that's something that we can change in the future and move in a positive direction?
Yeah, I believe there's, and I know for a fact there's companies out there that try and, how do I word it without being a dick? They try and ruin other veteran companies because they want to be the only veteran company out there that has a coffee shop, if you like.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's ones out there that just want to be I want to be the only veteran coffee shop. And that's it. So when another veteran opens up a coffee shop, it's got nothing to do with that coffee shop. They don't help that person because he's in the veteran community. They try and wipe him off, you know, get rid of that company.
But that's what we shouldn't be doing, though. Even though, exactly. You know, you're selling the same product, you should be working together.
And this is where I think we're going wrong, because we're not helping each other as a community, mate.
Yeah.
We're, if you look at the veteran companies in America, they're all on the ranges together, mate.
Yeah, yeah.
You see them on the ranges together. You see them doing podcasts together.
Yep.
You see them all helping each other out, mate. And they're, if you like, outside of the military, their companies have come together as like another community, mate, within that veteran community in America.
Yeah.
But here, there's too much competition, mate, and there's too much jealousy that goes on that I see. And that's what I believe, mate. Because again, there's always got to be one that's got to be better than the other. Oh, I was a Pathfinder. Oh, I was 2-2. Oh, I was 3-power. Oh, I was 1-power. Everyone's got to try and outdo each other, mate. Just cut the bullshit. Just trying to help each other out, mate. I mean,
yeah, just have the title veteran. Yes, you've served your time. It doesn't matter what unit you're in, but now you're a veteran. Let's all come together. Let's help each other.
I mean, I heard someone say not long ago, oh, the starter pack for UKSF is to start up an apparel company or a coffee shop when they leave. So what if it is? Like, say what? If that guy wants to go and do that, fair play to you. Go and make it work. And, you know, be the best at it. Be a pro at it. Like, if it works for you and it helps you, fair play to you. I mean, I've gone down a different road and work on the railway.
Yeah.
I fortunately had a friend who had a lot of money who helped me set this up, and, you know, and I'm very fortunate for that. But if you want to go, if you want to be like everyone else and open up a coffee shop in your town, that's got nothing to do with a military base, so be it. Just help that geezer out. But,
absolutely. You should be sharing ideas, perhaps. Like you say, if you know, there was two podcasts like they do in America, that they help each other out. I know.
Exactly. Do just swap. You go to his cafe and do a podcast, and you go to his coffee shop next time and do a podcast.
Exactly.
I mean, what's wrong with that?
For example, Eddie Penny. He's got his own podcast, but he went on the Sean Ryan show for 5 hours. Now, that was an incredible podcast. I've had the pleasure of interviewing Eddie Penny, and you know that synergy that they had together from working together for that one podcast has boosted Sean Ryan's show. But Eddie Penny, his Unafraid brand, has gone through the roof. So helping each other out that way has been amazing for each other. They could have gone in a different direction and try going, well, it's my podcast all about the Unafraid. Yeah. Well, no, this is my show. This is the Sean Ryan. But no, they come together because they're both veterans. They helped each other. And now they're both thriving from that one moment.
I mean, I think the veteran community, you know, even within a unit is quite toxic, mate, sometimes in the UK. I mean, I think it was about 3 weeks ago. I was walking through, so I live in near Bryce Norton.
Yeah.
I was walking from past this bar, and this guy said to me, Dave Radband. And I said, yeah. And he mentioned, I'm making the parachute regiment look shit by talking about what I talk about on Instagram and punched me straight in the face and split my nose.
Bloody hell.
I won't go any further. I won't say what happened after that for obvious reasons. But yeah, like, but even that, mate. I mean, there's people that don't like me. It's not even a business. My mental health, mate. I'm not talking about mental health. But because I've got so many followers and talk openly about what I talk about, people don't like it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at in America, mate, they all support each other talking about mental health.
Yeah. And I think that's the stage where we should get to, because, you know, it's, you know, it's very brave for a man like yourself, you know, quite a big chap that's done these amazing things, that's lived through these experiences, that you have, you know, you've come forward and you've talked about your struggles, your mental health struggles. Now, to me, that's incredibly brave. That doing that is amazing. To have somebody still in the old caveman ego of man up, you're a man, you don't have feelings, that's archaic.
Yeah.
That person that assaulted you is bang out of order. This should be the modern way of looking at things. And the only way that we're going to stop suicide rates for veterans, suicide rates for people on training. 2012, America lost more veterans to suicide than they did during the Afghan war.
Crazy, isn't it?
I mean, what does that tell you?
Mate, if that's not a reason to start talking and opening up and making people see the positive side of this,
yeah,
then I don't know what will change their mind, mate, because that's the only thing I see which makes people change their minds.
Yeah. Well, hopefully the UK attitude will follow suit with the US, and we'll start talking about these things. We'll start working together more. Stop the infighting and realize that, you know, we are a community, we're our family, we've got these shared experiences. It doesn't matter in which branch you served, there's always a commonality that we can find and talk together. One last question, two last questions I want to leave you with. What is the biggest piece of advice you could give somebody who's leaving the military and looking at civilian life? And the last question would be, if there's anything that you could change, if you could go back and give your younger self advice from the point where you are now, what would it be?
For somebody coming into the civilian world, mate,
yeah,
I'll actually change that one. Do your, what's it called when you're getting out the military, resettlement starts on day one, the first day you join the army. Start to have a plan when you leave the army, because you never know when that's going to end.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish I'd gone back and started to figure out what I was going to do when I leave the army way before I did, mate, because it was cut short like that and kind of dropped on my ass big time.
Yeah.
But don't go into the security sector. Have an open mind and go into other fields, because everyone stays in their comfort zone in the military, mate. Their comfort zone being security, mate, holding a weapon, putting body armor all the time.
Yeah.
And you're not gonna find out who you are unless you step outside your comfort zone. I mean, there's no growth inside your comfort zone, is there? Exactly. I stepped outside my comfort zone and tried something different, went to the rail industry, and I'm smashing it, mate. So step outside your comfort zone, look at other avenues to go down, and don't be afraid of taking a risk, because the core values you've got from being in the military, you can put into any line of work, not just security, any line of work.
Yeah.
People just don't know their worth in the military, mate. They think they're just told what to do all the time. And I mean, when you leave, you're going to know your worth. You're going to know your worth a lot more than you think you are.
Yeah. And what about the final question? If you could take some advice as what you know now and tell your younger self, what would it be?
I should have joined the RAF. I should have gone back to the recruitment office a week later.
Oh, bless you. Well,
I'll tell my younger self, probably be, I don't know, it's a hard question, isn't it, what I tell your younger self?
Yeah.
Probably, it's hard on that, mate. Do you know what? That's something I need to figure out myself, really. I mean, I know there's more I need to figure out, and that's why I'm going to go back and do psychedelics.
Yeah.
In America again. So I know there's more avenues I could go down, or there's more stuff I need to find out about myself. I haven't figured everything out yet. But off the top of my head right now, what would I tell my younger self? Probably comes down to emotion, to be honest.
Yeah.
Understand my emotion a lot more, or be more attached to my emotion. Don't try and be a man.
Yeah. Yeah. Have that emotional intelligence at a younger age.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I think, I mean, that's not, I try and tell my boy all the time. When you see, when I see my boy at football, he's in front of all his mates and he's you can see him holding back a cry. I'm like, just let it out, mate. Just get it out.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah. I try and teach mate, it's okay to have a cry, mate. But still kids at that young age are still trying to, you know, hold it all back.
That they do. Well, it's been absolutely brilliant speaking to you this evening. Definitely some words of wisdom. You've had an incredible journey. By the sounds of it, your journey's not finished. When the books come out, hopefully in the future, maybe we could sit down in a new studio face-to-face and have a good chat.
Yeah,
I'd certainly like to do that if we could. But again, thank you very much for your time. It's been very enlightening.
Thanks for having us, mate. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Take care, mate.
You too.